Well, thanks to Yves and Carolyn for the invitation. And so I don't forget, up front, Lionel and I like to acknowledge our support, mine from Cornell University and National Science Foundation, and also University of California at Davis, my home away from Cornell. Lionel's support is from the Florida State Collection of Arthropods. I've organized the talk today into three sections. First, I'll take a look at the historical role of larvae in the higher classification of the Neuroptera. And then I'll say a bit about the taxonomic status of the Neuroptera and larvae. And then I'll give a couple of examples from Lionel's work and from Maurice Tauber's and my work on the chrysopods. Now, to start with the history of the larval studies in the Neuroptera, today I'll feature three people whose work represents major milestones in the Neuroptera larval studies. Obviously, there are very fine other studies that I'm not mentioning, but these three give the flavor of the role that the larvae have had in the Neuroptera systematics. I'll say a little about each. The first is Cyril Withycombe, an Englishman who worked in the 1920s. Now, prior to his work, the classification of the Neuroptera was based almost entirely on the adult characters, primarily the wing venation. He was the first to include studies of the larvae in their biology. He died at the age of 28, but during his short life, he did pioneering work, and he proposed a comprehensive phylogeny based on both larval and adult characters. Now, his tree, which is pictured here, has stood the test of time well. I've shown the groupings in red that have remained stable in modern classifications. Now, this early tree is a testament to Withycombe's very fine work and also to the significant role that the larvae play in deciphering the evolutionary history of the order. The second milestone is the work of Maria Matilda Principi, an Italian woman who studied the Neuroptera during the late 1940s and the 1950s. She was not particularly prolific, but the quality of her observations and her drawings is spectacular in their detail, accuracy, and beauty. She set the standard that Lionel and I have continued to strive for. Now, here you can see a sample of her work on antlion larvae, but I couldn't resist showing you some of the drawings that she did of the chrysopod larvae. For each of the species that she worked on, she did close-up drawings of the individual parts, the dorsal and the ventral, external and internal views of the head, each thoracic and abdominal segment, and all the appendages. She stopped doing this work in the 60s. She went into administration and then continued to teach and direct students. She's now well over 90, and she recently wrote that she really misses the Neuroptera, but she's too busy taking care of her older sister. So, a role model for all of us. Moving on to more recent years, we get to the third milestone, and that's the work of Ulrike and Horst Asbach in Vienna. They've published the most comprehensive phylogenetic studies of the Neuroptera. Their work includes adult morphology, larval morphology, and molecular characters analyzed cladistically. It's not important now that you can't read the tree here, but I just wanted to show that they have two trees. On the left is their tree based on morphological characters, the adults and larvae combined, and on right is their molecular tree. The two trees have not yet been reconciled. But one item I do want to emphasize is that the Asbach's approach to morphological characters has been very rigorous. They've been concerned with establishing homologies. Their work is clearly illustrated, as you can gather from their color-coded drawings here. And they've made an excellent beginning and set a very high bar for future comparative analyses. Now I'll briefly touch on the larval taxonomy in the various Neuropterin families. And I'll use the Asbach's morphological tree as a basis for discussion. We'll start with the Nevrorthiformia. This suborder consists of one family with 12 rare Old World species. The larvae of this family have played a very special taxonomic role. Originally, the Nevrorthid species were placed in the Caesariidae. However, after Zwick discovered their larvae in 1967, the group was raised to family status and its basal position among the Neuroptera was recognized. Now, like the Caesariidae, the Nevrorthid has an aquatic lifestyle. The larva retains many megalopteran-like characteristics in the head and in the mouth parts. The Nevrorthid larva also has free Malpighian tubules, which are characteristic of megalopteran larvae, but not Neuroptera larvae. In the Neuroptera, at least some of the Malpighian tubules are fused to the hind gut. So almost entirely on the basis of larval characters, the family was moved to its basal position in the Neuroptera. The second suborder, the Mermeliontiformia, contains five families grouped here with the red bar. This suborder is monophyletic by all current measures. The larvae in the Mermeliontiformia are terrestrial, mostly ambush predators. They are characterized by a large number of very good synapomorphies, a couple of which are shown here. And here you can see the general structure and range of variation among the Mermeliontiform larvae. They're fairly diverse morphologically, but all are predators in subterranean or other hidden places. The psychopsids and the nymphids are two small families, and very few of the larvae are described. The Nemopterids and the Crocids are considered subfamilies by most authors, but Montserrat in Spain, who studied the larvae in detail, contends that the larvae are sufficiently different to separate the families. Lionel and I tend to agree because Neuropterin classification is very strongly based on the larvae, but we are a bit uncomfortable with the two-family solution because the adults appear very similar. The largest family is the Mermeliontidae, which contains the antlions. The larvae of this family have received considerable work by Stange and his colleague Bruce Miller. The Ascalaphidae is very closely related to the Mermeliontids, and the two can be considered a single family. There are no unique defining family-level characters in either the adults or the larvae. Now moving to the third suborder, the Hemerobiformia. This suborder contains the 11 families marked in red here. This group may or may not comprise a monophyletic grouping, and it may or may not be the sister group to the Mermeliontiformia. On the one hand, the Hemerobiform larvae do share a number of important features that distinguish them from the other two suborders. However, the Asbox molecular data indicate that the Nevrorthids, the Caesariids, and the Osmilids, molecular data indicate that the Nevrorthids, the Caesariids, and the Osmilids may have arisen through a series of splitting events that occurred before the evolution of the Mermeliontiform families and the other Hemerobiform families. So as the saying goes, the group really needs work. Now here you can see examples that show a broad range of larval diversity in the Hemerobiaforms. They are also very diverse biologically. The Ithaneids and the Polystichotids consistently come out together in the phylogenetic analyses. There's little published data on either family until very recently, when Dave Faulkner collected Ithonea larvae and Grebenikoff reviewed the larvae in the two families. Unlike all other neuropterin larvae, they are subterranean and believed to be phytophagous. Larvae of all the other families are carnivorous. The grouping of the dilarids, the mantispids, and the barophids is strongly supported by adult larval morphological evidence, but the grouping is not maintained in the Asbox molecular analysis. Dilarid larvae have been found in rotting logs. Their prey is unknown. The mantispids prey in spider egg sacs, or they parasitize wasp larvae, and the barophids are associated with termites. The Caesarid larvae are unique in that they are aquatic, they have abdominal gills that function in respiration, and they feed on freshwater sponges. The Osmilids are associated with moist habitats. They do not have gills, and their prey is unknown. The Chrysopids, the Hemerobeids, and the Coneopterygids are the three largest families in the suborder. They largely prey on terrestrial soft-bodied arthropods. Systematic information on the larvae of these three families is uneven taxonomically and geographically. There's no comprehensive family-level study of any of the three families that includes the larvae. Next, I'll take a brief look at the two largest neuropterin families, the Mammalianids and the Chrysopids, and try to give you a feel for the status and the value of larval systematics. I'll start with the ant lions. It's work that Stange and Bruce Miller have done. Among the neuropterin families, the ant lions are relatively well known. Stange's lifetime effort, The Catalog of the Mammalianidae, came out in 2004. The work is more than just a catalog. It also includes notes and keys to all the genera, including the adults and the larvae. There are three subfamilies of ant lions, and the larvae from all three are known. 38% of the genera are characterized, and about 14% of the species are partially or fully described. But the question is, how useful is this information in unraveling the evolutionary relationships within the group? Well, to make a long story short, the subfamilies are poorly supported by larval characters. Only about half of the tribes are well supported. But one thing that Stange has found is that the genera are usually well-defined on larval characters. It appears that in many antlion groups, the larvae diversify more quickly than the adults. Therefore, overall, there's a good degree of variation in larval characters. That's the positive side. On the other hand, there's been repeated evolution of sand-dwelling and numerous habitat shifts. As a result, homoplasy in larval morphology is common, so that's the negative side. So what's our conclusion? Our recommendation is for a rigorous phylogenetic analysis of the family using larval characters, adult characters, and molecular data. The group is currently in a good position for such a study. With the recent publication of Stange's World Catalog, the adult classification and nomenclature is in good state. There's a fair amount of larval morphological variation to work with, and larval specimens are available from a reasonably wide range of antlion taxa. The homoplasy in larval characters may offer some problems, but these problems may just make the study that much more interesting. Now let's move to the second largest neuropterin family, the Chrysopidae. Now I want to start by saying that potentially the lacewings may have similar types of homoplasy that the antlions express. For example, there's been repeated evolution of trash-carrying behavior in the lacewings. And trash-carrying behavior is generally based on modifications in similar structures across lacewing taxa. But once you get into the detailed morphological comparisons, you find good generic differences. To illustrate, Here you can see the larvae of four trash-carrying genera, each with its own set of larval modifications for holding trash. For example, Eumacrysa in the top left is the only genus with lateral tubercles on the first abdominal segment. The tubercles are missing on all the other genera. Among all genera, the size and shape of the thoracic tubercles differ, as do the setal patterns. So a homoplasy may not be the problem in the chrysopod larvae that it appears to be in the antlions. Now, to give a quick overview of the chrysopods, there are three subfamilies. The Nothocrysinae contains about 2% of the chrysopod species. Larvae of a third of the genera are described, and the subfamily is well supported by adult and larval characters. The Apocrysinae contains about 1% of the chrysopod species. The subfamily has very good distinguishing adult characteristics. The larvae are poorly known, and what is known does not support retaining the group as a subfamily. The third subfamily, the Chrysopinae, contains the remaining 97% of the species. You can do the math. Its monophyly is open to question, and with some notable exceptions in the European, Japanese, and some North American and Australian taxa, the larvae have not been included in tribal or generic level work. So what I want to do now is just to give a quick example from the neotropics to illustrate how the larvae can be very helpful at the tribal level. This beautiful lace wing elegans was described from Brazil in 1844. It was subsequently moved to the genus Birchmansis, which is in the tribe Leucocrysinae. Gilberto Albuquerque and Maurice and I attempted to rear this species, but we couldn't get the first instars to feed. But we learned quite a bit from the first instars. You will recall that the elegans is supposed to be in the tribe Leucocrysinae, but the figures at the top here show a typical Leucocrysine larva. The bottom of the slide shows the elegans larva, and it shows that it's quite different from the Leucocrysine. It clearly does not belong in Leucocrysinae. So we compared the larvae with the European taxa, and found that it's most closely associated with the tribe Belenopterygiinae. And this led us to make some corrections in the taxonomy of the neotropical chrysopods. With the larva, we placed elegans in the genus Vieira, which was in the tribe Leucocrysinae. And then we moved Vieira from the Leucocrysinae into the Belenopterygiinae. And then subsequently, I revised the small genera Vieira and Birchmansis. So now the tribes Leucocrysinae and Belenopterygiinae are a bit cleaner, and we hope a bit closer to monophyletic. All thanks to a very small, insignificant first instar larva. So to conclude, I'd like to return to the big picture and just say that the Chrysopidae has not received a serious, comprehensive phylogenetic treatment using any type of data, adult, larval, or molecular. So what the family really needs is a phylogenetic study using a broad range of characters that includes the larvae and with a broad and deep sampling of taxa. So are there any questions?